Welcome to Animal Airwaves Live here on WUFTFM, our weekly hour-long show devoted to the discussion of the health and welfare of animals. I'm Dana Hill. Happy to welcome back Dr. Bobby Connor from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine. We're going to talk about the do's and don'ts of animal emergencies. We'll take your calls, too. We'll be back right after this news from NPR. Welcome to Animal Airwaves Live here on WUFTFM, our weekly hour-long show devoted to the discussion of the health and welfare of animals. I'm Dana Hill, and I'm so happy to welcome back to the program from the University of Florida College of Veterinary Medicine, Dr. Bobby Connor, and we are going to talk today about the do's and don'ts of dog and cat emergencies. Now, we've had this sort of conversation before, but what's so great about it is that it never hurts to know this information. And, of course, if you have information at your disposal, you are going to be better prepared to handle some of the emergencies that may come up when you have an animal. And, of course, we don't want any of these bad things to happen to our pets, but they do. They are almost inevitable, sad to say. But if you know a little bit, maybe it can help you make the right choice as you face an emergency. So welcome back to the program, Dr. Connor.
Thank you for having me.
You work in the emergency department over at the vet school, right? You probably see on any given day, I don't know how many animals come in, but many of them may be coming in with some sort of emergency, given that you're in the emergency department. What are some of the common things that people come in with?
Yeah, coming in through our department, and we see just about everything. As far as, you know, medical emergencies, neurologic emergencies, things that, you know, there's not a whole lot that you can do to sort of prevent them. But we do see a lot of emergencies where owners can actually be a big part of either preventing them or kind of mitigating the problems if they're informed. And those are the types of things that we really like to get the information out as much as possible to pet owners, because that can make our jobs easier. And ultimately, you know, our goal is to, you know, get your pet home to you, you know, healthy and safe. And so some things you can't prevent, you know, the development of cancer, there's not going to be a whole lot you can do about that. Some of those do present to us as emergencies, but other things we can try to avoid, or as I said, at least maybe try to lessen the damage when an emergency comes up.
This is a lot like human medicine, right? You think of the myriad reasons people would show up at a hospital emergency room, and many of these are things that can happen to your pet as well. It could
Absolutely.
Be a physical trauma. Mm-hmm. It could be sudden acute illness. Mm-hmm. When people come into the emergency room at a veterinarian's office, their pet is probably at a point in which the pet owner feels frightened and alarmed, and often you don't know what's up. How do you kind of work with the pet owners who may be scared, who maybe don't feel like they understand what's happening?
Yeah, that's a big part of our job, actually, is just communicating with pet owners and helping them to understand what is going on. It's tough through our department because, as you said, a lot of the times we don't know. We don't know when they first come in the door what is going on. We don't have a full history. We've maybe never seen this pet before. Most of the time that's the case. And trying to get a lot of pertinent information very quickly from an owner who is scared and worried and emotional, you know, is tough. But we get better at that over the years, and we learn to kind of hone in and ask the right questions based on what we're seeing with this animal. Certain signs push us in one direction, saying, okay, this looks like this could be an intoxication versus this is clearly evidence of trauma, or, you know, maybe this was a more insidious onset. Dogs and cats are tricky, and I've said this before. One of the things that we both love about them and that can be particularly frustrating for us in the veterinary profession is that they don't complain. They're not complainers. They don't say, oh, I'm feeling a little off today. They kind of hide that. They hide that from their pet parents. And so we'll have owners come in, you know, with something that's an emergency today, and they say, this just came up. And from their eyes, it did. It's not that they missed anything. And so, yeah, a big part of our job is getting good histories and teasing out what, you know, could have maybe been brewing, things that they thought weren't a big deal. Oh, you know, Fluffy's getting older, and this is probably a normal progression. Maybe it's not. Maybe it was, kind of a harbinger of something more insidious going on. But the types of things that people really get panicky about are, you know, the traumas. You know, your dog gets hit by a car or attacked by another animal, you know, bitten by a snake. We certainly were getting into snake bite season here in Florida, and so we're starting to see the snake bite victims coming in. And those are obviously particularly worrisome for some people. But in other cases, for example, the coral snake. The coral snake won't, if it bites your dog or your cat, which happens less often, if it bites your dog, you're not going to see anything wrong with your dog right away. And so those are the kinds of things that pet owners can be educated about to say, okay, you don't have to be an expert in you know, herpetology and be, you know, to be able to identify what snake species this is. But if you see your dog around a snake, and you need to ask what's going on, because if that's a coral snake, your dog's going to be acting fine for maybe several hours and then could potentially progress and have a fatal outcome if we're not able to intervene. So it's not always obvious. And that's where things get tricky.
So we will get into some of the details about what these various emergencies may be and what a pet owner should do. But if I can tread back to the kind of the topic of talking with the pet owners who come in with a sick animal, I wonder if it is not unlike perhaps some sort of what a doctor might encounter in a kind of pediatric emergency room, in which a person is coming in with a child, and the child will obviously be uncomfortable in some way, shape, or form, but maybe not be able to articulate the problem. And you have to tease out of an adult what it is that's going on. This will vary from situation to situation, but tell me about some of the questions you might ask an animal owner to kind of keep the conversation focused on the important thing at hand, which is the health of the animal, but without kind of ignoring what is clearly a person who is in need of some reassurance, right?
Yeah. And so usually we start with, this is what I know. I've examined your dog, and these are the things I'm seeing, and these are the things I'm concerned about. You know, this is, whenever possible, it's great when I can convey good news that your dog or your cat is stable, and we have some time to kind of tease this out. Sometimes, unfortunately, you know, we put owners in a really tough position where we say we need to get some information quickly and make some decisions. And it's tough. I don't have a magic solution to make everything easy, because it's not easy. But the idea is to, you know, communicate. And so if owners can be prepared and have, you know, information like who their regular veterinarian is, and have that, you know, in their wallet that they hopefully have with them when they come into the emergency room. You know, some people do forget, they just grab the dog and go. But, you know, that type of information, so you don't have to remember every little thing. And we can sometimes, you know, contact the local veterinarian to get some medical history, which is helpful. But we'll ask them questions about, okay, you know, what's going on? Why did you bring, you know, Spot in today? And, you know, they have more information than they might realize. They really do. And they don't always know what's important and what's not. And so we might ask some sort of strange questions at times. But it's again, a way for us to kind of tease things out and steer the conversation in that direction. And, you know, we in the emergency department in particular are rushing a lot of the times. We're rushing them through. And sometimes we're not trying to be rude, but we'll interrupt and say, okay, nope, that's actually, we've decided that's not important. We need to focus over here. But asking about how they were before everything, trying to decide, is that, you know, was everything normal before? Even if it is something like trauma, it's important to know, was there some illness or, you know, disease process going on that's going to complicate matters? Yes, okay, you know, she was hit by a car, but does she also have pre-existing kidney disease? Those types of things are really going to alter how we might proceed with our stabilization, what medications we might choose to use or to avoid. And so, you know, it's not easy always from owner's perspective to have the presence of mind to think of all those things. And even when we ask questions, you know, things come up later. And a lot of it is repetition as well, asking the same questions either in a slightly different way or multiple times, things will be triggered. And so it's not that people are you know, intentionally misleading us, obviously. But, you know, is your dog on any medications? Nope, not anything. And then when you ask them again later, well, we did give some aspirin, and they don't think about that because aspirin is an over-the-counter medication that maybe they take every day for, you know, some underlying heart condition or for chronic pain. And that can be a really significant part of the history for us. And so, it's our job to really know what types of questions are most important. And again, to ask them direct, more directed or in a different way to trigger things for people. The other thing I find is children are particularly helpful for coming up with information. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. If the kids come along, they're always a wealth of information. They remember things that mom and dad often don't. No, mom, that's not right. It was this. And so kids are actually particularly, depending on, of course, how old they are, but kids can be really helpful for knowing what's been going on with Ginger or, whatever, and to give us some more information. And so I never discount the children in the room either.
Fascinating. You're listening to Animal Airwaves Live here on WUFTFM. I'm Dana Hill speaking with Dr. Bobby Connor from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine. We're talking about animal emergencies. Now, Dr. Connor, you work at a clinic that is 24 hours.
Yes.
And that means that when someone may not be able to reach his or her regular veterinarian, you are available. And there are other, of course, in other parts of the state, other 24-hour clinics. If you live in any sort of big city, you might have one of these available to you. And it's a great resource to have because certainly when you need it, you need it. And this means that people will maybe be coming into you who don't see you, your pet doesn't see them on any sort of regular basis, and you are kind of finding that you need information that might not be readily available to you right then. What can people know about their pet's medical history that would be especially useful to you as an emergency veterinarian?
I think probably the biggest thing is any medications the pet is on. Any medications. If you want to keep just a little 3x5 note card and, on your person that has a list of the medications, the dosages, when it was started, what it was for. Previous medical conditions are something that stumps us sometimes. And, sometimes there are complications with a medication. Maybe somebody accidentally, overdosed, or there was a pet sitter, and that type of information can be really helpful. If they know a little bit about previous surgical history, even if it's just, was she spayed or was he neutered at a young age, and how did he do from that? Any type of previous medical history is really helpful for us when we're trying to tease some things out. But a lot of what we do is, making decisions based on limited information. We gather that information as we go. And sometimes, the next morning we can call the regular vet and get this. But the more information you have about your pet's past medical history can be really helpful for us in some situations. Obviously, some situations it's more important than others. But the more you know about, any medical conditions and medications in particular is really helpful for us.
You'll be dealing with people who may have adopted a pet, mm-hmm. in which case some of the medical history may not be readily available. What happens then?
We do our best to, look at the clues, on the animal and, look for old scars or, if they've been microchipped and but a lot of times we just don't know. Mm-hmm. We have no idea. And we start with the information we have and we do the best we can from there. And some information is more important than others. When your dog was last vaccinated is important information, but probably not going to make a big difference to how I'm going to treat him if he got hit by a car. Mm. Those types of things are less crucial in an emergency situation. But it really can vary. And so it's, that's kind of our job. And we know that. We're used to that. We're used to working with limited information and we'll work around what you have.
A person walking into an emergency room will almost certainly be asked, are you allergic to any medications? Does that matter for our pets?
It does. It doesn't come up very often. And a lot of that is because, we're not taking, or our pets aren't taking as many medications and having the adverse reactions. Although in my experience, those pet owners that have had a pet who've had an allergic reaction usually remember that. Mm. And it usually is the kind of thing that they'll bring up to us. But if they've ever been to us before, we have alerts, in our computer system. But yeah, those types of things can happen. Those mix-ups can happen. But they're pretty uncommon in veterinary medicine. And so, that is kind of a standard intake question in human medicine, in human hospitals. But it's less of an issue for us typically. But certainly something if owners know their animals had a bad reaction. That'll come up sometimes with anesthetic drugs or sedatives. If your animal's ever been anesthetized or sedated for a procedure, and your vet told you, hey, he didn't really recover very well after the anesthesia, that would be helpful information to ask your vet and say, well, what drugs were used so that if he ever has to go to another vet in an emergency situation, I can pass that information along. And that's a really good point. Those types of things can be helpful. You know, that doesn't, if he had a bad reaction one time, doesn't necessarily mean he's going to have a bad reaction this time, because you never really know for sure what was the underlying cause. Maybe it wasn't that drug, maybe it was a coincidence. But if we can avoid things where we may have had a reaction in the past, that's really helpful as well.
My kitty Moggy is diagnosed with hyperthyroidism, and I only bring this up because I've noticed, as you were just saying, that she is allergic to a kind of thyroid medication that mm-hmm. she was prescribed, and we had to discontinue that pretty soon after she started. Now, if I were to take her into a veterinarian's office for any sort of emergency, I would probably try and mention to the veterinarian that she is hyperthyroid and that she is currently being treated for that. I don't know if that would necessarily make such a difference if she were brought in for snake bite or something like that. But the conditions that your pet has that may be chronic conditions, those can be important things to know.
Yeah, absolutely. And sometimes just so if I know that your pet has, you know, hyperthyroidism, I might have different expectations for the diagnostic tests I run. So if I run blood work and, you know, your dog has Cushing's disease, I'm going to expect some changes on, say, his liver values. And so if I know he has a history of that or is on a certain medication that can affect some test results, that's really helpful. So I don't go chasing the wrong thing for a while. So I don't go, oh, look at all these changes, I need to investigate X, Y, and Z. If I know your pet has condition X, I can say, yep, that fits, that's consistent with this chronic condition. And I can say, let's spend my time focusing on the new issues. And so that can be really helpful as well. And so again, knowing what medications they're on, knowing what previous medical conditions they have is really helpful for, again, not just so we avoid doing things that can complicate things, but we can focus our time and energy on what really matters and what's new and what's a change for your pet.
So let's talk about some of the diagnostic tests that you might run when an animal comes in, because these are going to be helpful tests to maybe clue you in to some of the conditions if the immediate cause is not apparent. And with any of these diagnostic tests, you must be going by some sort of standard or rubric that will help explain what it would be if the levels were normal, correct?
Right.
You have a baseline for normal?
Yeah, we have reference ranges for, like, for blood work that we run. What, you know, a normal dog's, you know, hematocrit or percentage of red blood cells should fall between about, you know, 40 and 55% approximately. And so that's what's normal for all dogs. Now, your dog might fall somewhere within that scale or maybe just outside the scale, but that's something that I can go by. And those types of, there's some really simple tests that we do very, you know, routinely in the emergency room, because it can give us a lot of information very quickly. So if you bring a dog in and it's got very dull mentation and, you know, it's sort of collapsed, it's very weak, can't get around, and I lift his lip and I look, his gums are very, very pale pink or white, I have really two differentials for that, two things that I'm thinking. Either he's anemic and is, you know, doesn't have enough red blood cells, so he's lost the color in his gums, or his blood flow is so poor that it's just not getting to the periphery. It's not getting to his skin. He's sort of holding that in and you know, perfusing or getting blood flow to his heart and his brain. And so I can do a very simple blood test that costs less than $15 to say, are you anemic and do you need a blood transfusion, or is this a blood flow problem? And I can start treating appropriately for that. So, you know, there are certain things when we examine in a patient on an emergency basis without any other historical information, I'm already starting to narrow things down and say, well, which is this and which is that? And, you know, there, so that's a really common thing we do when a patient comes in and it's in pretty bad shape. You know, our technicians and our doctors are well-trained. They go in and they'll talk to the owner very quickly and say, can I get some things started? Sometimes we have to do things before we even talk to the client and get some history. So can I get an IV catheter in and run some emergency blood work? And those are some of the things that we would do while we give pain medications or fluids or trying to get a few things started while we're asking you questions, because we don't always have that much time to wait for, you know, a good 30-minute history taking session.
Mm-hmm.
So, and we use those normal reference ranges that have been established from normal healthy animals. You know, we'll have laboratories that say, okay, we take a bunch of animals that are examined and assessed to be healthy, and we get their blood samples, and we kind of chart that out into, you know, kind of the the bell chart, and you know, who fall, most of them fall into that, you know, middle range, and that's our reference range, essentially simplified a little bit, but and then we can use that as our baseline even if I've never seen this animal before.
How quickly can you get back most of these tests that might need to be run?
A few minutes.
Yeah. Wow.
So in our ER at the University of Florida, we have some emergency, you know, blood work tests that, you know, sometimes you go to your vet and it gets sent out and you get those results the next day, or maybe if we send it through our central lab at UF, it could take a few hours to get those results, but we have, and we don't have all of the tests available that quickly, but the ones that we routinely use on an emergency basis to kind of help guide us in which direction we want to go, we can get blood test results in a matter of minutes. Mm-hmm. And we have to be able to get that information that quickly. And so, you know, we've got some of the things that are most important to know quickly and that could make decisions or help us make decisions differently. And we can get that back really, really rapidly. So sometimes we have more information even before we start to get the history from the owners.
Amazing. You're listening to Animal Airwaves Live here on WUFTFM. I'm Dana Hill talking with Dr. Bobby Connor from the University of Florida College of Veterinary Medicine. You're taking us to the area of the topic of time. Mm-hmm. Time is, of course, so crucial in an emergency situation. And I wonder if we can maybe help people who have pets who may be experiencing emergencies or maybe someday will. How can we help people understand what is critical when it comes to time? What do people need to be aware of if you feel like your pet is having an emergency?
Yeah, I think time is crucial for a lot of things. What comes to my mind first with time is the things that don't look like emergencies right away. So, for example, ingesting a toxin. If you witness your dog or your cat swallowing something that you're like, okay, well, that wasn't food, so could that be problematic? Waiting to see what's going to happen will sometimes lead to devastating consequences. There are certain toxins where we have a narrow window. And if we can get involved quickly, we can potentially prevent any complications. But once that pet starts to show adverse signs, there are some of these that we can't reverse that problem anymore. And so we certainly don't expect pet owners to know all of those things and which is the thing you can wait and see and which is not. And that's where a phone call can be really helpful. I just watched my dog. I tried to get it away from him, but he swallowed it before I could pull it out of his mouth. And, you know, call your local veterinarian, or if it's after hours, your local emergency clinic, and say, my pet just swallowed this. What do I need to do? And if we say you need to bring it in right away, it's because you do. You need to bring it in right away because we don't have a lot of time. There are a number of toxins, or again, like with certain snake venoms, where time is of the essence. And we can, again, potentially completely prevent any adverse signs. But once those signs start to show up, there's not as much we can do.
Wow. So that should give people pause, because when you... I've been in this situation, right? I've seen my cat chewing on something, and I don't remember giving her any food, but there she is chewing on something. Now, maybe it is just she found a piece of food that she dropped somewhere.
Right.
That could happen. And I'm ashamed to say now that I have sometimes allowed myself to just reassure myself that it's nothing, no big deal.
Yeah, and probably more often than not, that's going to be fine. The problem is when it's not fine, when it's not one of those things. And it just came up today, actually. We've got some friends staying at our house, and we have a sago palm in the back of our home. And hopefully most of the people in Florida now know that sago palms, all parts of that plant, are toxic to dogs and cats if they're ingested. And so our friends have a dog with them, and our dog will be fine just hanging out in the yard. And I was like, nope, the dog's going to stay inside if somebody's not supervising. Because if we can prevent exposure to some of those things, that's great. But that's one that we see a lot in Florida. My dog was chewing on some sort of seed. Is that going to be a problem? I don't know. It may be completely benign, and a lot of the plants around here are going to be completely benign. But there are some that's not the case. And if we're not sure, our recommendation is almost always going to be let's be more aggressive and let's go looking for that. We can induce vomiting and say, okay, we've looked at that seed. Now we can go through the vomit and we can pick out the bits and pieces of the seed. And we can say, oh, turns out this was not as big of a deal. And yeah, you spend a little bit of money, but your dog's going to be fine, versus nope, that is the one we're worried about. And now we have the time. We're in that window where we can do a lot to prevent a problem.
People have the luxury of a resource like poison control. Mm-hmm. I know on the inside of my medicine cabinet, there's a piece of paper taped there. It says poison control. And it'd be great if there was a service like that for pets. But I wonder if you know of any resources that someone could turn to quickly to know, okay, my cat just ate a little petal off of this one flower that is in a vase on the coffee table. And, well, okay, it turns out that's okay because that's this, but it's not this.
So one of the resources that I use all the time is actually the pet poison control. So the ASPCA has a pet poison control hotline that you can call. Now, there is a fee associated with that phone call. Usually it's less expensive than an emergency room visit. But they also have on their website a fabulous, at least for plants, they have a resource of plants that are poisonous to your pets or not, and with pictures, which is wonderful because if you're like me and you're not a botanist, you're actually terrible at identifying what a particular plant was. And so there are resources online, but that would be one I would direct a lot of pet owners to, ideally before you put any plants in the area where pets can reach them. I know when I was walking into Publix the other day before Easter, they had a big Easter lily display, and I wanted to run over and put a big sign up saying, poisonous to cats, you know, beware.
Yeah.
And because they're, you know, beautiful plants, people like to have them around, but we've had a number of Easter lily toxicity cases come in recently because people just aren't aware, and they're beautiful flowers, or friends send them to them, not thinking about it. My advice to people is before you bring any new plants into the area where your pets have access, so whether that's indoor or outdoor, depending on your animals, you research it and you say, you know, what is that information? And the ASPCA, if you go to their website, theaspca.org, and you go to the pet poison control, they have a list of toxic plants. And I use that one all the time myself. There are certain ones that we obviously run into commonly and know off the top of our heads. So you can always call your veterinarian or call, you know, the UF in Gainesville, and we can help you sort through that as well. But again, prevention is always better if you can just try to avoid exposure. But cats are funny. They're carnivores, and yet they still like to chew on plants.
I don't understand it
I
either,
don't either.
Except for maybe that it just visually strikes their fancy and they want to go for it. Moggy tends to be pretty okay about this, but it means that we don't keep some of the plants in ready reach. That is to say, we know places that she wants to go, and we try not to keep flowers in a vase there. That isn't to say that she couldn't figure out quite easily how to jump on the kitchen island. She could,
right?
But she'd have to really want it.
Yeah, and there are varying degrees of toxicity as well. Some that will cause gastric irritation and make them vomit and feel kind of crummy for a couple of days, but are not likely to be fatal, versus others that are much more dangerous. And so, you know, you kind of have to weigh that out and say, okay, well, our cat doesn't really seem to be interested in chewing on plants, and so we're fine keeping, you know, these types of plants around, and of course some that are completely benign, knowing that if she ever did get into that, okay, she's going to feel kind of crummy, but probably not going to lose her, versus these, which could be fatal. And no matter how pretty they are, for me, I would say keep those completely out of reach or not have them at all. And then dogs, you know, as we all know, dogs eat all sorts of things that it just defies reason why they would. And we will have dogs come in that have had, you know, a plant in their yard for years and have never touched it. And for some reason, they got it in their head that day they were going to chew on it. And so, oh, he's been around that for years and never had a problem, isn't for me enough justification to not be wary of those types of things.
Great. We're going to take a short break, and we will talk about some of these other toxicities, but I want to remind everyone, you're listening to Animal Airwaves Live here on WUFT-FM, our weekly hour-long show devoted to the discussion of the health and welfare of animals. I'm Dana Hill, speaking with Dr. Bobby Connor from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine. Now, today is our pledge drive. It just began this afternoon, and if you would like to contribute some money to the station, and I certainly hope you would like to do that, our telephone number for that, 392-9838. We're going to take a short break. Back right after this. Welcome back to the program here on WUFT-FM. This is Animal Airwaves Live. I'm Dana Hill, and we are talking today about animal emergencies. My guest is Dr. Bobby Connor from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine. Now, I mentioned before we left off that this is our pledge drive, and you've probably been hearing about it for the last week or so, and I don't want to sort of beat it into your head, but if you are able to contribute and you have not yet become a member of WUFT, our telephone number is 352-392-9838. 1-800-273-8. Now, Dr. Connor, before we left off, we were talking about some toxicities. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the classic sort of toxicities that we think about in terms of our pets include some food toxicities, particularly as it relates to dogs. And maybe you can go over some of those right now and maybe dispel some myths, maybe kind of let some people know about what is really serious and maybe what is a little bit less serious, but still something that should be of concern.
Yeah, the foods, I think one of the ones that we run into and can be particularly frustrating is grapes and raisins. Grapes and raisins for both dogs and cats. We don't know what causes the toxicity in dogs and cats, and not all dogs and cats will develop signs of toxicity after ingesting a grape or a raisin. But we know that some animals, after ingesting a very small amount, literally one grape or one raisin, can develop signs of kidney failure, or at least kidney injury. And so we'll have people say, nah, they're full of it. My dog's, you know, been eating grapes for years. And that may be very true. And so if your dog has been eating grapes for years and is fine, it may be that it either has a higher tolerance or doesn't have whatever, metabolic derangement that might make one animal susceptible. And so we don't know, because we don't know the mechanism of toxicity. But if your dog is naive and has never had a grape or raisin, I would recommend avoiding it, because it's just not worth it. And it's not necessarily something they need in their diet, so let's avoid that one. That's one that in some animals can be devastating, and again, can cause severe kidney injury and potentially can be life-threatening. Other things like chocolate. Chocolate is something that, you know, is delicious and people like it, as do dogs. Not so much cats. We don't run into cats getting into that as often. But the problem with some dogs is they don't eat, you know, one Hershey's Kiss. I guess that's the problem with some people as well. Mm. But a dog might get into a bushel of chocolate, and depending on what type of chocolate that is, that can be a major problem for them. Generally, the darker the chocolate, the more potentially toxic it is. And then this one is on a kind of a dose-related basis. So unlike grapes, where we don't know how much it's going to take to be toxic in one animal versus another, in chocolate, we can kind of predict that. And so your dog could consume more milk chocolate and be okay versus some dark chocolate or baker's chocolate. White chocolate actually isn't chocolate. It's the butter that's left over when you're making chocolate. I don't know that much about it, but I know there's no actual toxic effects of white chocolate. Although there is always the risk of your animals eating rich foods that they're not used to, causing pancreatitis, which is inflammation of one of the organs in the abdomen, and can also make them very sick. So even if they're eating something that's not toxic, eating something they're not used to or shouldn't be still could have some deleterious consequences. And so, you know, my family gets really mad when I say that dogs are sometimes very similar to children, but you have to watch them very carefully, and dogs never kind of grow out of that phase. So even older, you know, geriatric dogs can still manage to get into some trouble and eat things they're not supposed to. And so we always have to be mindful of that.
I'm so glad that you brought that up. And I don't mean to make it sound like we're picking on dogs here, but as anybody who has had a dog knows that, you know, the food that we eat is often very interesting to our pets, mm-hmm. especially dogs. They have a very good sense of smell, and what you're eating may smell very, very good to them. They will eat a lot of things that, frankly, cats just don't want to touch, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I know that you could probably give a lot of dogs things that cats just wouldn't even be interested in eating. Now, there are probably lots of reasons for this in terms of evolution, but suffice it to say that this poses extra risk when we talk about things that may not be good for them. And of course, if you have ever left the dinner table for a couple minutes mm-hmm. and come back and seen your animal kind of getting into something, then you know what can happen. Now, I will play fair here and say that I have walked out of the room and maybe left a bowl of ice cream on the table and come back and seen Moggy just go into town. Now, the problem there is not really serious, because I'm generally not eating ice cream that I think would have anything bad for her.
Yeah.
And I understand that cats don't really even taste sweet stuff, so I'm not sure what she's after except for maybe the fat that's in the dairy. But with cats, what kind of food toxicity should we be worried about? Because they can get into things.
They absolutely can. And a lot of the same things that dogs will get into, cats can get themselves into trouble. It does seem like they're less likely to either get into those things or into the same quantities that dogs will. But there are, you know, grapes and raisins are also dangerous for cats. We've talked already about plants and Lily, so they're still eating maybe things that aren't food, but they can still get into trouble. Foods are less of an issue for cats. For cats, it's more, you know, strings or other maybe non-food items that they're playing with and you know, sort of accidentally ingest or swallow. And so we'll get, we'll find needles attached to those strings. And, you know, so cats will swallow things like a sewing needle. So cats are definitely not completely safe around the house either. And then some cats are different in their personalities and will eat things they're not supposed to. We just don't see it as often. So we do occasionally get a cat that's eaten some chocolate, and the chocolate covered raisins in particular are going to be worrisome because that's kind of a double hit. But no, cats really aren't as prone to, you know, getting into the garbage and eating things they're not supposed to as far as food items go. I know my cat loves hair ties, and if I leave my hair ties laying around, you know, he'll go and hopefully just play with them, but, you know, maybe sometimes ingest them, and that could be a problem. So every animal is different, though. And so as pet owners, I think you have to get to know what your particular animal's weaknesses are and try to keep an eye out for that. And if you have to, you know, either put the garbage behind a door they can't get into or get a cover for it, or, you know, again, you can't walk away from the table when you're eating. Some dogs aren't going to care, though. Some cats aren't going to care. Everybody's different.
Well, so let's talk about what a person might want to do if he or she should find that, oh my gosh, my needle and thread are missing.
Yeah.
You know, that if you're the only one there besides your cat and you know you didn't do anything with it, and now what should you be looking for in your cat, and how do you know when it's an emergency?
Yeah, obviously if you see the cat, well, the cat was just playing with the string and the needle and now it's missing, well, let's play the odds. And I would probably recommend, you know, you could go into your vet. If there is a needle still attached to that thread, that would show up on x-rays. So you could take your cat in, or your dog, they do that every once in a while as well. You could take it into your local veterinarian and they could take some x-rays and we could see the metal in the needle on an x-ray. The string, on the other hand, is not going to show up. And so for that, if there's just what we call a linear foreign body, and you're essentially going to have to wait and see what signs show up. And you'd be looking for lethargy, not wanting to eat, certainly any vomiting would all be signs that you probably need to have that pet examined.
Because what's happening there is that this foreign body is in the cat's stomach and is causing upset?
Well, it's probably not directly causing upset so much as it's anchoring in one location. So a linear foreign body will kind of lodge in one part of the intestinal tract, the entire intestinal tract. Sometimes it's at the base of the tongue. And as the intestines are doing their job and trying to move things through, one end is anchored, the other is moving through. And just like when you pull the cord on your sweatshirt to, you know, pull your hood tighter, that's what's happening to your intestines. They're getting bunched up. And so you get this sort of accordion of the intestines, and that can be really dangerous. And sometimes those have to be removed surgically. If not, we can get perforations or breakage in the intestines and causing leakage of the intestinal contents into the belly. And again, that can be life-threatening. So.
Right.
So if it moves through and passes out the other end, you got really lucky. But if it lodges in one end and the other end keeps trying to pull through, that's when we get into trouble.
A topic that I hate to bring up because it's so, for lack of a better word, traumatic to even think about, are the severe traumas that animals can experience, particularly animals that are able to get outside. And the possibilities are myriad. Any kind of contact with an automobile can be really, really rough. A contact with another animal. I've seen it where cats get in fights with raccoons.
Yep.
So let's talk about some of the dangers that are outside and what people should really kind of be on the lookout for.
Yeah, it's, you know, our animals are going to be spending some time outside, and especially people, you know, that are maybe out in the country and have indoor-outdoor cats, or who aren't and have a cat that either, you know, accidentally gets outside, or dogs that manage to get, you know, off-leash or out of the yard. They're absolutely at risk for, you know, some types of trauma. So whether it's a vehicular accident, getting hit by a car, or getting into a fight with another animal of any species. We do see that, unfortunately, quite a lot. Again, of course, prevention is always ideal, and I'm a huge proponent of leash walking your dogs. Even if you have the most well-behaved dog in the world, somebody else might not. And if your dog's not on a leash, it's really hard to intervene and pull those dogs away. So that's my little plug.
It's also the law in Alachua County.
Yeah, and it's a good one. But it's common sense that even if your dog is well-behaved, it should be on a leash when it's not in an enclosed yard. But for those times when accidents happen and they get out of the yard or out, you know, slip out of their leash, you know, trying to be safe about intervening, being aware of the types of injuries that they can have. Obviously, we worry about, you know, wounds and bleeding wounds. You know, with a lot of bleeding, you know, it's always a good idea to put pressure on wounds, but being very careful because that may cause your pet pain. And so when pets are painful, they try to communicate to you that they don't like what you're doing. And sometimes the only way they know how to do that is to bite. And so you want to be careful not to put yourself at risk. And so if you have a muzzle available, muzzling, you know, your dog, or, you know, kind of wrapping your blanket and your cat in a blanket before you're trying to do anything sort of miniature, you know, immediate first aid. So putting pressure on bleeding wounds can be helpful. Trying to stabilize your animal and minimize moving. If there's any, just like in people, if there's any worry about, you know, a back or a spinal cord injury, you know, getting some type of, you know, stiff board or something to rest your animal on for transport can be a good idea if at all possible. But usually in those situations, it's get it to your vet as soon as you can.
Is there such a thing as animal CPR?
Of course there is. Yep. And we certainly perform that in the hospital. It's a little bit trickier. In people, you can get CPR certified and learn human first aid. And so there's a lot of out-of-hospital resuscitation attempts because first responders may be bystanders if you've been trained. At this point, that's an uncommon thing in veterinary medicine. Most of the people performing veterinary CPR on dogs and cats are trained veterinarians. There are some programs, though, where we will train other first responders. I've been involved in some training programs before where we will train like paramedics or firefighters how to do some basic, you know, emergency first aid. If they've taken some advanced courses, maybe even doing some CPR in animals because, you know, they're the closest trained personnel or people who work with search and rescue dogs want to be able to, you know, help their dogs in the event of an emergency. But most of the time, out-of-hospital CPR attempts are not going to be successful in our veterinary patients. And it just depends. In people have a lot of heart attacks outside of the hospital. And so those efforts can be a little bit more successful than if it's after trauma. You know, your dog got hit by a car, it's probably going to need a lot more than just CPR. It's going to need maybe a blood transfusion or some fluids or oxygen that you're not going to be able to provide in the field.
So it's safe to say that any sort of hit by car accident is an immediate trip to the veterinarian's office.
That's always going to be the recommendation. Even if your dog walks away from that or your cat seems to be okay, things can sneak up on you. You can't see inside your pet. You don't know if there's internal bleeding. And we do have those things happen. If they have damage to their lungs, for example, and there's a leak in their lungs, they could have what we call a pneumothorax, where there is air around their lungs, but still inside the chest. And that can leak every time they take a breath. That leak is a little bit bigger and a little bit more air develops. And over time, their breathing gets more and more difficult. And if you wait until they're showing signs, again, by the time it takes you from that point to transport to a veterinarian, they're going to be in a lot worse shape than if you brought them in right away. So anytime there's any type of trauma, you know, scuffle with another animal, the recommendation is always going to be to have that pet examined by a veterinarian as soon as you can. And best case scenario, everything checks out and your pet is okay and we don't have to do anything more. But it's better to have a veterinarian make that call.
With human beings, it's become a lot more of a concern in the case of accidents to look out for brain injury.
Yeah.
And it's understandable because what can happen is sometimes people can get up and walk away from an accident, appear okay, mm-hmm. claim, I feel okay, I don't think anything is broken, and you get up and walk away, but the danger isn't over.
Right.
Does that happen with our animal friends?
It absolutely can. And so a lot of times, even when we examine an animal and say, you look like, you know, he was pretty lucky and we're not finding any major issues, we're usually still going to recommend some basic diagnostics and maybe monitoring for 24 to 48 hours, depending on maybe we have, like you said, head injuries or brain injuries. If there's scrapes and bruises around the head or the face, I'm going to be much more concerned about possible, you know, know, traumatic head or brain injury. And so I might be more inclined to ask that owner to leave their pet with me for a day versus if it was a hind limb that was injured. Maybe I'm not going to be quite as concerned.
Yeah. When we talk about traumatic accidents, things like car crashes and whatnot involving our pets, broken bones, are those sometimes the lesser of the injuries that you're worried about?
They sometimes are, although they can fool you as well. But a lot of times the broken bones are, you know, the scary and obvious things. But if your pet suffered such an impact that it was able to break a bone, think about all the other soft, squishy tissues that are not going to be as able to withstand that type of impact and what type of injury those tissues have suffered. And so anytime there's a broken bone, you already have to assume this is some pretty significant impact. And the bone maybe did its job and absorbed a lot of that impact as part of the skeleton to, you know, to like the rib cage to protect the lungs. But if there's a fracture to a rib, okay, well, what else did the lungs sustain? Now, a rib fracture is probably not going to cause any fatalities. It's going to be painful, which is significant. But the underlying tissue, the lungs, that could be a big problem. And so, yeah, the broken bones are very important and, you know, need to be addressed and the pain needs to be managed. But the animal in general needs to be assessed for how is it breathing? What's its circulation like? What's its neurologic status?
I want to talk of a scenario that people may have encountered before, particularly with cats, though I suppose it's possible with dogs too, and that is that you haven't seen your pet for a day or so, and then you find your animal. You don't know what's happened, but the animal is kind of in hidden somewhere, looks frightened, doesn't appear to be normal. Should you assume emergency?
Yes. Yeah, I would say, you know, every time. Cats are funny and they do like to hide when things go wrong. And so, yeah, you know, we get those histories a lot. You know, my cat, you know, he goes out every day, but he comes home every night and he didn't come home for two nights. And then we found him under the porch. And sure enough, there's either a bunch of bite wounds or other injuries. Or the other thing with cats is they'll suffer bite wounds and then 6 days later they'll seem sick because what they have is an abscess. So they got into a scuffle with maybe another cat or a raccoon or something and suffered some bites and scratches, which were maybe fairly minor, but those nails and teeth aren't sterile. And right. So they can introduce bacteria that initially isn't a problem, but as the wound heals over and the bacteria have a chance to sort of set up shop, then the cat develops an infection and 2 or 3 days later or sometimes longer, then it comes in feeling sick. A lethargic or hiding or depressed animal, especially one that's been missing for a bit, needs to be seen by a veterinarian as soon as possible.
Towards the start of the show, you hit on this, but let's reiterate, don't give your pet animal medicine. Don't get your pet human medicine should you find your...
Although I would argue that you were right the first time too. If in an emergency, don't give them any medications without advice from a veterinarian. For example, say your dog has arthritis and he's taking a non-steroidal, like an aspirin-like drug or something like carprofen. A lot of the listeners probably have pets on that medication. And your dog got hit by a car and you think, well, this is a pain medication and surely my dog's painful. That medication under those circumstances may not be safe. And so my advice to pet owners is in the event of an emergency to give no medications if it's a new problem. Now, if your dog has heart failure and it's on medications for its heart failure and its signs of heart failure are progressing, yes, please continue those medications. But if this is a new problem, don't assume a medication that was safe yesterday is still safe today. You can call us. Call us at, you know, again, 24/7, 365 at the university. We will be there to answer questions. Is it safe to give my dog this carprofen that was prescribed for him and he's been getting today? We will be able to work through that with you. But please, no human medications.
We don't have a lot of time left, but I want to bring up something that I think might be a don't for pet owners. Don't be too embarrassed to bring your animal in, right? Maybe you did something dumb. Maybe you left some food out or something that was dangerous to the animal. You could do anything. Maybe you accidentally closed the door on your animal's paw or tail or something. But don't be too embarrassed to go to the emergency room to get your pet treated.
Please. I promise we don't judge. We're not going to say, oh my gosh, you're a terrible pet owner because you know, your dog was sleeping under the car in the driveway and you backed up without checking first. You know, that happens. It happens to us. We all make mistakes. We all leave things on the counter that we know we shouldn't have. You know, you're getting ready to take your medications. You've got the cap off. It's sitting on the counter and the phone rings and you step away for a minute. Or you're clumsy and you dropped it. I'm clumsy. I drop things all the time. And if your dog was right there and ready to snatch it up, please Again, if it's a matter of, you know, this could make a big difference for how we treat your pet. So not only don't bring them in, please bring them in and then tell us everything you know. You know, any information you might think it's not as important, or it may not have an impact, but it's better if we have the information and then we can decide if that was pertinent or not. And we really don't. We're not judging you. We're not going to say, oh, what a bad pet owner, because you brought your animal in is the bottom line. You called us. You did the right thing. You're trying to get the information, and we're going to do what we can to try to help you through that.
Dr. Bobby Connor from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine, thank you so much for coming back and talking to us. This was really a great topic and really good, important information.
Great. Thanks for having me.
I want to say thank you very much to Richard Drake and Glenn Richards there in the control room, Sarah Carey at the Vet School. Of course, this is our pledge drive. If you have not yet contributed, I hope you will consider making a pledge, 392-9838 or WUFT.org. I'm Dana Hill. I hope you'll join us again next time for another episode of Animal Airwaves Live. Bye-bye.